We start with a case that stirred the controversy, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, which went all the way to the Supreme Court. Rebecca Miles reports on media reaction to the ruling, the devil in the detail of the case and its implications, according to supporters and dissenters.
10 minutes past 6 o'clock now this morning, corporations and labor unions have the ability to throw mega dollars into political campaigns. For decades, they were restricted, but yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court voted 5-4 to lift limitations on what they can donate. To understand the impact on you, the voter, we are joined by Dr. Grant Neely from the University.
We've been making steady progress, but this week, the United States Supreme Court handed a huge victory to the special interests and their lobbyists, and a powerful blow to our efforts to rein in corporate influence. This ruling strikes at our democracy itself.
Or paying for politics? That's the question, and that's what a new Supreme Court ruling today voided. They voided the old restrictions on corporate campaign spending. But does this mean government politics will be run by big business initiatives? Well, in studio with us today to discuss what this means for Main Street is David Hoyt. He's Director of Development for the Young Americans for Liberty. Mr. Hoyt, thanks for being here. So what does this decision mean?
Well, it means that the role of individuals is actually going to be greater in the long run. And it means getting rid of the McCain-Feingold Act, or at least parts of it, that were completely unconstitutional on First Amendment grounds. And that's what the court found today.
This is Larry Lessig. I'm at the San Francisco airport about to get onto a plane to fly to Boston. And I've just had a chance to skim the extraordinarily long decision of the Supreme Court striking down limits on corporate speech in the context of political campaigns. I think the point is we need a political system where people can trust that the decisions Congress makes are decisions based on the merits, on what makes sense or what the people in their district want, and not what the funders demand. This decision will only exacerbate the current problems with this system.
That was news reporters and commentators reacting to the Supreme Court of the United States ruling in January earlier this year in the case Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. The decision overruled two precedents about the First Amendment rights of corporations. The court said the government may not ban political spending by corporations in candidates' elections. Brad Freeman is an investigative reporter and editor of The Brad Blog, an independent, award-winning website that covers the election system. Freeman said this is a case that will live in infamy.
It really changed the entire game, and I think you may have to go back to Dred Scott to find a decision in the Supreme Court that was so ill-considered, frankly, and so dangerous to the nation as a whole. Folks at the time thought, well, maybe the opponents of this decision were overstating the dangers. And I think we're seeing now, over the last couple of weeks and as we barrel towards Tuesday, that the concerns were not overstated and that this has seriously changed the game of the way democracy, and I'll have to put that in quotes at this point, is actually carried out in this country.
The Dred Scott case decision said that a freed slave could be recaptured and is still the property of the original owner. The case in January involved a documentary called Hillary the Movie, a 90-minute stew of political commentary and advocacy journalism produced by Citizens United, a conservative non-profit corporation, and was released during the Democratic presidential primaries in 2008. Here's an excerpt from the Associated Press.
If I had been president in 2003,
the Supreme Court says this movie,
oh, she's flipping, she's flopping. No, she's not flipping and flopping. She's lying.
Is not the same as a political commercial. The producers of Hillary the Movie wanted to distribute the film by video on demand through local cable systems during the 2008 presidential campaign.
Hillary is really the closest thing we have in America to a European socialist.
The Federal Election Commission filed a lawsuit against Citizen United saying it violated the McCain-Feingold campaign finance laws passed in 2002. Those laws barred certain corporate-funded television broadcasts, such as a documentary, in the period before an election. Citizens United made a claim for the First Amendment rights of corporation, which led to the case being heard in the Supreme Court. Freeman says this case only benefits individuals if you consider corporations individuals.
This is another damning part of this case, is that it once again reiterates sort of previous findings of the Supreme Court that, in fact, corporations are people. Never mind the fact that they don't breathe, that they can't vote, that they can't get married, that they never die, that they can't be thrown in jail. Somehow, they are afforded all of the rights that actual real individuals, not fictional ones, you know, are afforded when it comes to elections. Now, I guess that's fine, but, you know, the amount of money, if I'm able to give unlimited money to any candidate I want, that's great, but I'm not sure that I can compete with a Walmart or a McDonald's or a Target or take your pick of any, you know, corporation, fossil fuel industry, ExxonMobil. I can't compete with them as far as the amount of money that I have to spend on an election versus the money that they have to spend on an election. I mean, it's just completely out of balance, and it really underscores this fiction that corporations are people, and they just aren't. And I'm almost astounded that I even have to make that argument, but that is the argument being made by those who support Citizens United, that in fact corporations are people, they are individuals, and they may do whatever they want in an election, never mind the fact that they can't even vote in an election. So they're voting with their pocketbook, and of course they have, you know, record profits with which to do this. I don't. You don't. Most Americans don't. So it really is an unlevel playing field and a real bastardization of our electoral democracy.
The 5-4 decision was a vindication, the majority said, of the First Amendment's most free speech principle. The government has no business regulating political speech. The dissenters said allowing corporate money to flood the political marketplace would corrupt democracy.
Rebecca Miles there on Meet the Press, Sunday, October 17th. Host David Gregory heard from Michael Isikoff, the national investigative correspondent of NBC, on the dangers of the Supreme Court ruling. David Brooks from the New York Times, who argued the money was more hype than real. E.J. Dion of the Washington Post outraged that notion. Rachel Maddow, host of MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show, citing the millions being spent. And Rick Santelli of the Tea Party, stating that the real issue was process. The piece starts with Michael Isikoff.
Not since the days of Watergate have we seen special interest money pouring into political campaigns with no transparency, no disclosure about where the money is coming from. You've got groups being set up around the country with names that voters have never heard of, bombarding the airwaves with campaign ads. And I think what this is doing is confusing voters more than enlightening them, because they have no idea who's behind these ads or what the agenda is of the people who are running them.
Yeah, you wrote, David, this week, you don't think this is a big deal. You think this is more hype than real.
I think it's tremendously corrupting on Washington. The question is, does it affect the electorate? Mm. And I guess, does it affect voters? A couple things. First, it's important to remember the outside money is only 10% of the total money. Most money is still candidates-driven, and it's party-driven. The second thing is the money is flowing in on both sides. Ask me, the public sector worker, $87 million. The NEA, $40 million. So there's a ton of money.
Though. But that you do know where they're coming from.
Right, that's exactly right. The untransparent money is a genuine problem. But then this third thing, the final thing is, does it affect voters? We've got $3.5 billion being spent on this election. Some of these outside funds like Karl Rove's American Crossroads, they're spending $12 million. Do we really think that's affecting? And then if you've got a race like in Colorado where the Democrat and the Republican are each throwing 5,000 ads at each other, do we really think if one candidate throws 7,000 as opposed to 5,000, it's going to make a big difference?
I really don't think so.
Yeah, I think it's big. First of all, Karl Rove's group is spending a lot more than $12 million by their own account. There's a lot more money coming in. In total, these secret conservative groups are going to spend about $200, $220 million, according to the current estimates. The money matters, and secret money is corrupting. Secret money is dangerous. Secret money, as Mike Isikoff said, leads to scandal. And the Watergate, we forget that a big piece of the Watergate scandal was secret money. And to say this money doesn't matter is to say that Karl Rove, who really cares a lot about politics, is wasting his time trying to raise all this money. Ed Gillespie, who knows a lot about politics, is wasting his time. And for voters, you know, people will know about this money. The congressmen are going to know who helped them get elected. The only people kept in the dark are the voters. Mm. This is a huge deal, and it's historic, and it's dangerous.
Yeah, the Rove money, I mean, I don't know where you're getting the $12 million money.
That's from the Center for Responsive Policy.
They are bragging on raising and spending $52 million. They said that was their initial goal, and now they say they're going to blow past that and spend significantly more. So the numbers, we fight over the numbers. One of the issues, though, is that they're not disclosed. 72% of people in the last NBC Wall Street Journal poll said it concerns them that they do not know who is funding these political ads. And I think part of the issue is not just that there's these big PACs, but it's the individual people. The owner of the Chicago Cubs could legally contribute $2,400 to Sharon Angle, who's his chosen candidate. He doesn't live in Nevada. That's his, but he's spending $600,000 personally for Sharon Angle in Nevada.
But part of the issue here is that this is the law of the land. Okay? Now, is there the political will, and Democrats are in control, to actually change the law? Because Michael Steele was right. This is the law. You want to change all of this, Democrats and Republicans have to agree to change the law, because this is what the Supreme
Democrats
Court has passed.
Tried. Republicans
blocked
it. You
know, the pendulum of money swings both ways, and depending on the year, the state of the incumbents, the outcome of the elections, different sides cry foul louder than other sides. But in the end, there is a process. I personally think money in politics on any level is horrible. I'd like to see a set amount and have every candidate spend it, have it be completely transparent. But actually getting to that spot, as we have learned through all the legislation over the decades, is very difficult. But yes, whether it's the Supreme Court or some of these issues regarding transparency, there is a process. I am a firm believer in process.
All right.
Meet the press there. New York City's public advocate Bill de Blasio has launched an initiative in reaction to the Supreme Court ruling, backed by a number of other officials. Rebecca Miles reports.
Elected officials from New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, North Carolina, and California have formed the Coalition for Accountability in Political Spending, or CAPS. The group saw the need to do something after Congress failed to pass legislation addressing the landmark Citizens United ruling. New York City's public advocate, Bill de Blasio, launched the initiative. He said he's looking at the problem from the perspective of someone who oversees the city's $30 billion pension fund.
As we've seen, when corporations think there's great possibility in engaging the political process, either through spending on elections or through lobbying, often they start to go astray. And there's no better example in the world than the auto industry in this country, which for decades avoided creating fuel-efficient cars and avoided addressing environmental issues because they basically had such support in Washington that they didn't need to deal with the normal rules of the free market.
De Blasio and other elected officials hoped Congress would pass the Disclose Act, which would mandate corporations declare their role in political ads and ban government contractors and TARP recipients from funding political campaigns. But Senate Republicans blocked it twice. De Blasio said he wanted to see if he could convince companies this was the wrong path to go down.
You know, we had our coalition kickoff the other day, and the state treasurer of Pennsylvania, Rob McCord, I think said something very simple, that just because it's a law doesn't mean you have to do it. And that our message to companies was, you know, Citizens United has opened up all these new veins of activity, but they're not necessarily the right thing to do for your shareholders, for your consumers, for your role as a part of the democratic process or as a corporate citizen.
Using his leverage on the city's pension board, de Blasio says he's convinced J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs to refrain from direct electioneering. In a written statement, Goldman Sachs says it doesn't use corporation funds to make political contributions in the United States, nor does it spend these funds on electioneering communications. Currently, those involved in the CAPS initiative are all Democrats, but as the campaign revs up, they hope some Republicans will sign on. The group is also approaching non-financial corporations like Massey Energy, 3M, and Best Buy, who are all supporting conservative candidates. De Blasio also wants more transparency from 501c3 groups, which he says spent $22 million on electioneering since September 1st. He joins another coalition criticizing the Chamber of Commerce for reportedly using foreign contributions on election spending. Kevin Zizi spearheads the campaign StopTheChamber.com. His group is calling for the Department of Justice to investigate recent allegations the chamber is using foreign money to influence political campaigns.
This aggressive fundraising effort, which makes them the biggest player, bigger than any of the political parties, and this aggressive outreach to international corporations puts the Chamber of Commerce in the position of probably breaking the law, because it's against the law for foreign sources of funding to influence elections in the United States, and that's clearly what the Chamber is doing.
The U.S. Chamber rejected the allegations as myth and said its American Chambers of Commerce, or AmChams, in foreign nations are independent organizations that do not fund U.S. political programs. And New York public advocate de Blasio isn't only targeting conservative groups. In a recent letter to 16 associations and nonprofits, he also urged the League of Women Voters, NARAL Pro-Choice America, and the National Wildlife Action Fund to disclose any contributions they receive from corporations for electioneering.
Rebecca Miles there reporting. Now millions head to the polls tomorrow morning in New York, the tri-state area, and across the nation. And today, frantic last-minute campaigning is taking place. Having heard the detail on the ruling, supporting and dissenting reactions, initiatives by officials in reaction, and we're joined by two voices to explore what this means for the people and politics and what happens to local democracy on the ground, in the communities, in our neighbourhoods, for you and I with this ruling and its consequences. Laura Flanders, host and founder of Grit TV. Laura is a New York Times best-selling author and editor of the brand new book released just today, At the Tea Party, The Wingnuts, Whack Jobs and Whitey Whiteness of the New Republican Right and Why We Should Take It Seriously. And now that's available exclusively from allbooks.com. And we're also joined by Councilmember Jumani Williams of Brooklyn's District 45. Councilmember Williams and Laura Flanders, good morning to you both.
Glad to be here.
Good morning, how are you?
Very well, thank you so much for joining us. So we really wanted to lay out all the steps and go through all the different detail of the Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission ruling. The big discussion, does this declare war on democracy? Laura Flanders, let me start with you.
Well, I think it's a whole new antitrust tradition. Remember that nice quaint phrase that was embedded in the language of the early part of this country? Well, that's a new spin today, in that we have a political system that is building no trust in our democracy. And I think that what we've seen is a real rolling back of a very fundamental American concept of independence. You go back to that early language of the founders around independence, and while Zephyr Teachout at Fordham lays it out very well, it was about independence from corrupting influences, whether it was royalty or huge corporations. It was written into the law. It survived through the law. It was the concept of American democracy throughout the early part of this country's history, certainly up until about the 1860s. What's happened since is a growth of a kind of legal argument around free speech and corporate rights, and we've essentially turned the basic American democracy concept on its head, where now, where you heard the speakers in your segments talk about it, you've now got a situation where the only free speech rights that are being protected are those of corporations that have decided to get themselves defined as people under the law. And it's not just setting our democracy back. I think it's undermining the fundamental precept of American democracy, and it's not unrelated to the growth of groups like the Tea Parties, who are simply not trusting the politicians that they've got. And they're not the only ones, of course. They have their colleagues on the left, their equivalents on the left.
So, Councilmember Williams, what does this mean for folks like you who seek office? How's it going to change the options that the electorate have when you have all this money literally being thrown at elections in the way that we've seen as a result of the ruling?
You know, well, I think first and foremost, it's the ruling, it's obscene and it's deceptive. Which is a problem. It's obscene because what it says is that money now truly does trump everything. Before we would say, you know, money is too much, it's undue influence, and we all know that, but now it's allowed to reign supreme. And it's deceptive because obviously they're not disclosing everything. Someone who's watching something may think that this is completely impartial when it's not. And those two things, I think, make it really obscene and deceptive, and it worries me because if it's just money talking, then you get thrown off on the ideas that should be discussed, and you get thrown off on the candidates and what they really represent, because all it is now who can outspend who, and it has nothing to do with the issues. And I heard someone speaking earlier about comparing it to the Dred Scott case, which I didn't mind too much, because I think with the Dred Scott, what happens is I think the decision was fundamentally flawed because human beings shouldn't be considered property. And I think this ruling is fundamentally flawed because corporations, regardless of how you think of them, are not really human beings and shouldn't always be treated as such.
I guess what's quite extraordinary for so many people is how does the Supreme Court arrive at the fact that a corporation could, that a collective can be the equivalent of an individual? Just by definition, what is available to a corporation to spend versus an individual makes it, at the very least, definitely not equal. But the notion of enabling somebody to not disclose, what has happened where the fundamentals of what is considered democracy have been repealed in a way that is, frankly, many would argue, quite devastating for the people?
Well, I think the Dred Scott decision is a good comparison, because this may be either a high water or a low gutter mark, whichever way you want to look at it, where people really look back and say, you know, this is unacceptable, this is really going too far. But there are two things going on here. One, you have the party political complicity in this process. It was, 4 years ago that Democrats were all excited about the new types of C4 organizations that were raising money on their side. So they've had an investment in saying, oh, look, we're going to do politics in a whole new way. You had the Obama campaign spending, it may pale by significance now, but it was over $4 billion in 2008. This year we're on track for, I think some people are saying, a $5 billion election. So you've got some party complicity, but then you have the immorality, which I think where we the people come in. If you're looking at a $5 billion election at a time when we have people in trouble from coast to coast, cuts of every kind of public service, cuts of every kind of help to the neediest, I think you're going to see a reaction. And I think that you're going to see a reaction at the House level, where you have districts that are spending, well, you've got some of these House seats, I think people have done the counting, they're spending like $4 million per House seat. Think how that money could be spent. So on the one hand, you have party complicity, corruption of our political system, and then you have this economy out of whack, which enables some corporations to have the kind of assets that we're talking about. And I think that's the bigger question. We can legislate and disclose and transpose and whatever you want, but as long as we have a handful of people in this country with half of all of the assets and wealth and income that comes into this country, we got a power problem and we got a democracy problem. And that's, I think, where it gets deeper than just Citizens United. It gets very deep.
Capitalism is always to blame fundamentally when it comes down to the bottom of the pile. But just look at the numbers for a second. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, this election is set to come in at $4 billion. That's more than the 2006 midterms, which cost $2.85 billion. It could even eclipse the 2004 presidential campaign. Can you imagine that a midterm is more expensive than a presidential campaign? That's what's happened with the money. But the question that I wanted to put to you, Councilmember Williams, is that really what does it mean? How does it change the options of who will end up even running for office and who is likely to represent the people? Like, what would it mean for somebody like you trying to run now with this new ruling? Does a certain kind of folk have a chance in hell?
I really had an opportunity because of New York City's campaign finance board. Although sometimes I find them a little annoying with the paperwork, I understand what they're there for, and they're the reason that I was able to win, because it capped how much you can take. You can take any money from corporations. It capped how much an individual can give to you, and it gave you an incentive to agree with it, and it capped how much you can spend, which really focuses you on focusing on the issues. It gave you an incentive by getting the public matching funds, and it prevented undue influencing from corporations. Now, if you don't have that, community organizing like myself probably won't have an opportunity to run unless you can raise billions of dollars, which is, obscene. As was mentioned, that money can be better spent someplace else, and now we have to focusing it on spending on elections, which is absurd.
And it's also unlikely. That's the bigger point, that's just simply not going to happen, and so it narrows does it not then narrow considerably the likely options of who's going to even run, which just changes, it changes the notion of what democracy means for the people quite specifically. Laura, you raised this question about political will. And one of the questions that was raised in the Meet the Press discussion is where is the, because now the Supreme Court ruling has made it the law of the land, but where is the political will to introduce the legislation that turns this over? One point that Bill de Blasio said that it may be the ruling, it may be the law of the land, but it's actually not right in terms of the notion and the nation, the notion of democracy and what that means for the people.
Well, I think that you are ironically seeing some of this notion, some of this argument around morality being raised at the left and somewhere along at the Tea Party right. You've got Tea Parties who are certainly underwritten by huge corporations, but you go to the actual meetings and you find people who are furious about the control of, as they see it, liberal elites over their political system. Now, I think you're actually likely to see a pretty interesting play out of all of this election, where whoever gets elected on Tuesday, you're going to have a lot of grassroots folks on the sort of Tea Party side who are very angry, not just the day before the election, but after the new Congress is seated. They're not going to get what they want. They're going to see themselves as having been used by Karl Rove and his machine, and they're going to be left, and our chance again will be, can we find some connection, some way to connect with that anger about the state of our democracy that gets beyond the kind of MSNBC Fox food fight and gets into a question of real organizing on the ground to not just reclaim the democracy that we have, but build a stronger one. Because let's face it, our democracy was also set up to protect wealthy landowners, people who were the privileged class, have always protected their privilege. We have a major project on our hands, but I think that Citizens United kind of breaks it all open pretty bare.
Councilman Williams?
I think, you know, like you were saying, with these new laws, someone like me could not, I don't believe, hold office, because you just don't come. I just didn't come from money. I came from organizing and grassroots. It's very tough to compete with that type of funding from corporations. I do think that, you know, the political will eventually fix this, whether it's through Congress, whether it's through the Supreme Court itself. Like Dred Scott, many years later, they passed Brown versus the Board of Education, which kind of changed that a little bit, and hopefully it doesn't take so long. But it's really, you know, an absurd definition of, you know, the crux of it was political speech versus campaign speech, and it was a very absurd definition of political speech when clearly these things aren't, and they're campaigning, and they're campaigning hard, and they have a political point of view, and I think it just got it wrong, and I think eventually it's going to be fixed. I just hope it's sooner than later.
And that's the question, is what price do we the people pay while that eventually waits to happen? What happens to democracy while you're literally waiting? And the Republicans have done a really good job of harnessing fear. Fear is its own political machine right now. And it's certainly been one of the major driving forces of the Tea Party, turning fear into anger and making that something real. But as you said, ultimately, people like Karl Rove, who are about the acquisition and the maintenance of power primarily, and that power being very limited and specific, ultimately, you are, it's like overturning 500 years of American evolution, such as it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got several things going on here. I mean, on one hand, you talk about fear and the role of the media and all this stuff. On the other hand, at Grit TV, we just ran a three-part series on the Chamber of Commerce. The power of the Chamber, which raised something like $200 million over the last year, has become the number one lobbying force in Washington, spends more than either of the two parties, has become the third big political party force, if you will, in this country. Speaks to the power of just brute money. And they can say that they, on the one hand, you've got the BP CEO saying he's all about the cleanup, and then you've got the contributions to the chamber working to stop the possibility of raising the responsibility cap, the liability cap for companies like BP. You've got, on the face of it, health insurers saying, yes, we want reform, we want to help you, but their contributions to the chamber mean that the chamber is out there spending millions of dollars a minute to oppose healthcare reform. You've got organizations like there aren't any other organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but the CEO of the chamber simply lies about that foreign funding, simply lies about the way that the money is spent, and there is no transparency. So I think first comes first is transparency, but then at the end of the day, we've got to get beyond ooh, look how bad it is, to this has got to be changed, and it's got to be changed, I think, at the local level. And my colleague on the line is so important because he's talking about laws that are in place at the local level. That's achievable for local people to get involved in. And when you've got campaigns around this country for publicly financed elections, for elections in places like Portland and Maine and Arizona, where you've had efforts to try to have cleaner elections and public financed elections get through the legislature, it's really stirred up this issue at the local level in a way that stands a possibility of building movement.
Well, we know, just listening to Rachel Maddow and Meet the Press there, that the Democrats did indeed put a bill forward to actually overturn the Supreme Court ruling. It was blocked by the Republicans, no surprise there.
With enormous amounts of money from the Chamber of Commerce.
Once again. And so with that in place, Councilmember Williams, talk about the force of the power at the local level to really create the kind of shift when we're going to keep seeing that the Democrats will put forward the bill, but ultimately this ruling really does benefit the Republicans, who've never been particularly shy at saying that they have the right to get money from whatever source that matters in order to hold on to power. How successful would something like Bill de Blasio's CAPS be, the Corporation for Accountability?
Well, first, I think I'm hoping, my personal opinion is hoping that the Republicans don't win on Tuesday. If they do, I think there might be a shift in discussion. I think this is all about power right now, and they don't have power. Once you get power, sometimes the fervor that you had before starts to wane a little bit. So that may also happen. On the local level, it's extremely important, and I think definitely doable. I even think a little bit above local is also doable. It's all about people understanding what's going on and understanding how important it is and framing the message. And locally, most people can understand the undue pressures of money. And people get mad when they feel that they're being deceived. And I think that's what happened here with the campaign finance board. People got upset and frustrated, and it was incentivized in a way that it's better to take this money and get matching funds and get public money to help you run your campaign and follow these specific rules, which just makes sense. It makes sense to cap spending. It makes sense not to be able to receive as much money as possible from a corporation. It just completely makes sense. And I hope the media, you discussed the Tea Parties, and although there is a huge rage and anger, I think the media did a lot to really spread that further and wider. And I hope that, this was some responsibility for the media now to spread this message of fear about what this ruling can do and what the laws are now to people, so they can rise up in the same kind of uproar.
The only problem with all of this, of course, is that 80% of all that campaign spending goes to the media. Who is it that
Absolutely.
Enriches themselves more than any other single sector of our economy during an election season? It's commercial media who run those ads. So you've got an interest also on the media side not to cover this too carefully, too assiduously.
And certainly not too thoroughly in terms of who profits and who pays and who loses ultimately. But let me pick up on the point that you made, Laura, as well about ultimately the Tea Party discovering, those who belong to the Tea Party discovering that they've really just been used in order for the Republicans to harness what was really a lost cause in terms of the win in November 2008 of Barack Obama, and finding themselves lost at sea and harnessing something that has turned into, went from a moment into a movement. How likely are we going to see that rage turned around on the discovery that this was just being used, and they are no more going to be listened to once the Republicans get whatever seats they get than they were going to have been before that happened?
I think it'll be interesting who becomes the target of the ire. In some ways, if Republicans win control of both chambers, it'll be hard, I think, for the focus of the fury to remain on Barack Obama. Maybe. If the Senate retains Democratic control, then you'll have a more, greater capacity for confusion about messaging, who's responsible for what, and you'll see Democrats, I would imagine, bending over backwards to try to get some things done with a very, very controlling majority of Republicans in the House. But the question that you're raising is the big question, and it goes back to exactly what it is that has brought us to this point. I think on the one hand, you have a simple disaster of an economy that has left, according to David K. Johnson on Grit TV last week, one out of every 34 of us without any kind of a wage in 2009. Wow. People who had had jobs in 2008. You've got 74 of the top, the 74 top wage earners. We're not talking about people that don't live off wages, but wage earners, seeing their income in that same year of recession increase fivefold from $91 million a year to $518 million a year. Obscene amounts of money being made by a tiny few and a vast array in tremendous pain. The question is, how do we build movement out of that that isn't this sort of partisan catfight that we've seen over the last 2 years, but instead is really focusing on the real stuff, which is power and money in this country? We've seen, you know, a right-wing gain because it was able, I believe, and the statistics show, to combine an economic situation with a black man in the White House and build on that to sell Tea Party as another's a message that it was poor white people that were being sold out by vicious, you know, people of color-led elites in Washington. The problem for us progressives is that we've failed to raise a voice and an agenda clear enough that could say, wait a minute, let's refocus. What are the real problems here? And how do we build alliances that actually move people forward? The good thing about at the Tea Party, the collection that I'm just coming out with, is it does show what's working on the ground. There are activists who talk about fighting back extreme right movements, militia movements, and others in Montana, in Idaho, in Utah. And they talk about what's working. It's not undoable, all of this. It just needs to get done fast.
And the Democrats have traditionally not been great at getting across their message to the degree where they're not either being drowned out by the Republicans or on a constant defensive around that, which also just always just makes you look like you're in a position of weakness. So then going to the ground, Councilmember Williams, which is where you operate from, what can people do as they're watching this play out? What is it that they can do to say, okay, we want to be part of this fight back movement and make sure that our elected officials understand that this is something we want overturned? Because in New York City, we've done special after special about every single public sector that is either being shut down, wiped out, services gone, whether it's libraries or public schools or homes for elders, homes for HIV/AIDS. I mean, the list is long. And to hear how these numbers are being cut and the amounts of money being cut, and then to hear about a $4 billion campaign, it's almost beyond obscene in an economy which we're being told is in recovery, but people still feel that they're living in a depression.
So first I want to say, you know, let's make sure we understand that this is only about people who don't have power anymore and want to get that power at any cost and any possible measure. Like Pataki, who is a Republican, when was in power, completely was in favor of transparency and blocking this kind of spending. Now he's doing the same thing himself. And I think with the Tea Party, one of the main problems is it's not rational. It's an irrational, gut-wrenching anger that's being that's what's being used and abused. So what happens after that power, that gut-wrenching anger and fear-mongering will be hard to sustain. At the same time, I think on the ground, what the left has not done is harness that same gut-wrenching, irrational emotion. And sometimes it's necessary and sometimes it's effective. I don't think it should be done all the time and done in the way the Tea Party's doing it, but the left has to use that same kind of emotion. We use a lot of logic, which is great, but sometimes people just need to be pointed out. You have no money. These people have a lot of money and are spending on it. You should be angry that you can't pay your bills. You should be angry that you cannot pay for housing. And just use that gut-wrenching anger that people will have when they think about these things. And that, you know, that's the only way on the ground. I think as on the left, sometimes we're a little too nice when it comes to this, and we've allowed people to take our direction, have taken our tools, and use it in a much more effective measure. We just need to take that back and apply it.
It was kind of
too
interesting.
Nice. They're totally ineffective.
It was kind of interesting in that New York governor's debate, crazy though it was. I mean, the rent is too damn high party guy, he did find a resonance with his message. Everybody on that crazy platform was forced to sort of take up the call, and it was just one glimpse of when somebody really speaks it up on those issues, clearly there's a power there.
And that is universal. the rent is too damn high is like folklore. That's like an anthem that should be iconic when it comes to not just New York and the tri-state area, but across the entire country. So when we come down to the root cause, because ultimately millions of people going to the polls tomorrow. One of the questions David Brooks raised in the Meet the Press segment is that it's actually more hype than real. What will it mean for the electorate on the ground? And I wanted you both to address that, because that's been a tone of this argument that is building more traction, that somehow it is more hype than real.
It's much more hype than real. First of all, that is fundamentally flawed, because even if both sides spent obscene amounts of money, it's still obscene. And it's still not money that's put to good use. Mm. So it's still very, very, very real. And so I take offense to that, because he's assuming that money can't be spent to feed people and to put people in housing. There's much better ways that we could spend this money in an economy like this. And I think it just skews the way people think about the issues when it comes to election day. And I'm, you know, we can all kind of try to figure out what's going to happen on Tuesday, and I really don't know. I know what I'm fighting and pushing for, and that's to prevent the Republicans from gaining power and the Tea Party from gaining power, but we don't know what's going to happen. But I do know that things are skewed. Now, when you have the emotional rage that I was discussing, and now you have unlimited money to put toward that, there's no way that the real issues come out in a way that makes the most sense. And so I believe people go to vote, they're voting on the wrong things, and that's very real.
So are voters being clouded by the manner in which this issue has distorted what the real issues are for folks? Because I think folks are still real clear. At the end of the day, they recognize what they don't have. And to see this amount of money being spent, I mean, $4 billion is a small GDP for some African nations. You know, like that's when you think about some of the headlines where food stamps that are at an all-time high across the entire United States of America, the comparisons are really strong. Part of the argument, isn't it, Laura, is the progressives' failure to harness just how obscene this is as an argument for progressive politics.
Well, I hate to say it, but it goes back to 2008 again. Barack Obama was the first presidential candidate to dispense entirely with public funding, to run his campaign on private money. It was a great, glorious thing on the in Democratic eyes back then. It was before Citizens United, but essentially it was part of the process that brought us here. So there is a sort of hypocrisy on the Democratic side and a complication when it comes to how do they really address this and polarize with the Supreme Court over this issue. But when you ask about what's the impact on the ground, I think there's two things to worry about. One is that you've had such an onslaught of television advertising is that you could see suppressed turnout because people are just so fed up. And in any democracy, unless that suppressed turnout is really well organized, there's some kind of protest, it's probably not a very positive step. And in this case, you've got the most motivated people most likely to be the ones to come out, and that's probably on the right. And on the other, you've got races like Colorado. I mean, last time I looked at the numbers here, the amount of money from outside the state being poured into that important Senate race is, you know, we're looking at something like $13.6 million just between the beginning of September and the middle of October by Rove's groups, skewing the chances there for the Democrat Michael Bennett against the Tea Party candidate Ken Buck. Nevada, same thing. Hugely important race, whatever you think of Harry Reid and who doesn't. you know, Sharon Engels raised $14 million to his $2.8 in the third quarter of the year. Wow. Again, huge difference. And these candidates on the Tea Party side can say we're independent, but that money is coming from old Republican sources. These are Republican campaigns, old school GOP campaigns, whether the face of them is Sharon Engel or the face of them is someone else. And I do think it's affecting not just who runs, but what they campaign on, what the possibilities are for policy, and the degree to which anybody cares in this country or decides, you know what, there isn't a democracy here. This country is just being run by clans. We better get a clan together and get some guns.